Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. I'm going to start our program today by talking with you about caring for loved ones with dementia. There are a lot of things that we need to consider when we have a loved one with dementia. Maybe you have one right now. Maybe you will in the future. Unfortunately, that's the case for many, many families. We have two guests, one with me in the studio. Susanna Waters Castillo has her PhD and master's as well in social work, works with the programs on aging and long-term care in the Division of Continuing Study at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Susanna, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
With me by phone today, Tipa Snow, a certified occupational therapist and a dementia expert. She trains and consults for healthcare professionals and families, and she does that privately. So it's great. Tipa, thank you so much for being with us by phone.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about dementia. Let's talk about the basics of dementia first. What is dementia exactly, and what can cause it?
Well, this is Susanna speaking. Dementia is a constellation of diseases. There are different types of dementias. The most familiar one to all of us is Alzheimer's type dementia. Then there is vascular dementia, there's Lewy body dementia, and then there's mixed dementia that can include vascular dementia and also frontal temporal lobe dementia. And there's some other types of dementia, but the most familiar one to all of us is Alzheimer's dementia. And it's a very serious cognitive decline that is not reversible and progresses over time. And it is due in large part to deterioration of the neurological structure in the different lobes of the brain.
My mother died from Alzheimer's, so we have very much firsthand experience in our family with us. It's certainly not a fun thing to have to deal with for, I'm sure, the patient, but also for the family members, Tipa.
Absolutely. I mean, dementia and any form of dementia affects more than just one person. It affects the entire support structure for that individual because over the course of the disease, it ultimately makes independent living and living life very challenging, and to the point where you've got to have somebody there who's providing not only care but hands-on lifting, moving, because ultimately all parts of the brain are impacted by the disease.
Yeah, we were very fortunate. My sister retired early, came home, and lived with my mother for the last several years of her life, and so was a wonderful caretaker. So we were very fortunate to have her with some help from the brothers and the sons. So what are some of the can we identify various stages? Or maybe let's go to the earliest signs. What are the earliest signs that someone might be suffering from dementia, Susanna?
Well, we're finding more about the fact that Alzheimer's can begin in people 10 to even 20 years before visible symptoms actually occur. And, of course, what we see in mild cognitive impairment is the beginning of memory loss, short-term memory, but it is not as steady as when it advances into the actual, disease stage of Alzheimer's disease. And what happens at that point is people actually begin to lose their familiarity in one sense with what is most common, what is most important to them in their life. And anyone can go on to the website here in this area, the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance, which lists those common symptoms. At times, some people will fear that they're having the disease when, in fact, it may not be. And if the family is concerned about a relative having dementia, it's very important to have a proper screening. And the state of Wisconsin has about 12 early diagnostic and screening clinics that are strictly devoted to dementia, where the more sophisticated screens can be presented to the family in an environment that is not threatening and information then is shared appropriately. And then following that, I really encourage families to get in touch with their Alzheimer's Association. I remember one time reading that when you are dealing with a chronic illness in a family, it is just like adding another family member, the disease itself, and that it stays with you. Yeah. So that extra support is absolutely essential.
We have an email from James. This might be one for Tipa. James says, being an RN, I've dealt with dementia ranging from giddiness to fear related to the hallucinations inherent in it. It's difficult professionally, and I can only see it being substantially more difficult for the family. And I'm sure Susanna or Tipa could comment on this. But Tipa, let's go to you.
I think one of the hard parts for family is you've known the person as they were, and it's very difficult to let go of that sense because initially these symptoms come and go. They aren't solid state, so it's sort of like a toggle switch. Sometimes it's on, sometimes it's off. So 10 minutes ago, I absolutely could have balanced the checkbook, but right now my brain cells aren't doing what they should, so I'm doing something like writing the check for the car payment three times and skipping the one for the house payment. And yet when you ask me, of course I wrote that. I mean, what are you talking about? And so I get very frustrated and angry. But then I turn around and I'm fine 15 minutes later, and I want to know why you wrote three checks. And this on-off, this sort of hit-and-miss, sort of misremembering of information is close enough to what we all experience with forgetfulness sometimes that we get a little nervous about labeling it as dementia. So we have the family dynamic of we've known this person, and they always had a little bit of something, but now it's converting, and it's hard to pick up on that for many people. Or sometimes we're pointing fingers instead of really thinking through what does this mean long term. So, yeah, I mean, it's a real challenge for families because you're losing the person that you've known right in front of you while you still have somebody there that you're caring for.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Levon emailed and said, her mother has dementia, and the hardest thing so far in her mind has been getting the emergency care for the sudden onset of frightening delusions, mm-hmm. causing a patient to lose sleep or refuse meds or not eat, escape, act aggressive.
Yes.
One of the really tricky things is there's three, they're called the three D's. Yes. It's not all about dementia. There's dementia, there's delirium, and there's depression. Mm-hmm. Now, a real rapid switch up where you don't see weird thinking and seeing things or thinking things that aren't true and that starts happening, even if someone has dementia, there's a possibility it isn't the dementia, but they have a bladder infection or they're having an upper respiratory problem or they're dehydrated. And she's right, it's hard to get the right care because people see the label dementia and they assume everything they see is that. And in fact, you have two diseases or maybe even three because depression is incredibly common, both as a predisposing condition but also a condition that people can have at the same time as they have dementia. And so it gets messy because not everybody who's depressed is sad. Some people are sort of angry and mean because they're depressed.
And as she says, she thinks that patients need a safe place to stay when some of these things happen, like a hospital, so the delusional behavior can be treated with, I don't know, antipsychotic medications,
yes.
For example. Dementia patients should have the right to be safe and receive treatment, is
yes.
her comment.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that in two parts. One is the fact that a lot of emergency room professionals don't recognize that someone is delusional and don't run the proper lab tests. But with those lab tests, you can rule out certain things and find out whether or not this is a urinary tract infection and so forth. And the important part of having a safe, comforting environment when someone is going through a delusional experience is so important. A delusion episode can last up to 6 weeks and more, even though the infection is treated. So that individual, number one, needs a quiet resting place where they can actually sleep, in one sense, through and heal their body. So that hospitals need to recognize that, and when the individual is transferred to a nursing facility or back home, that safe environment is so important. And I studied in Northern England with the Bradford Dementia Research Group, and I had the privilege of going to a variety of nursing facilities that offer these kinds of safe environments for people that are post-delusion, post-acute experience, and that offers a safe environment with few, if any, physical restrictions and the proper medication. So I have seen how that works, and we need to advocate for that and make sure the proper lab tests are done to rule out the disorder when they are brought to the emergency room.
Well, LaVon, thank you so much for your comments. I'll turn to Jeff next. By the way, before we go to Jeff in Madison, if you'd like to join in with a question or comment, you can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page. You can post a comment there at The Larry Mueller Show or give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Jeff in Madison now. Jeff, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Yes. I just finished a book your guests may know of called The Brain That Changes Itself by Norman Doidge, I think his name is pronounced, Dr. Doidge. And it's a book that's gotten acclaim from Oliver Sacks and a lot of others as well. It came out 2007, in which he provides a lot of very clear scientific evidence that the brain is what he calls plastic neuro. It's a case for neuroplasticity, meaning that we can lay down new neurons and neuronal networks right up into old age, at very advanced ages, by learning and focusing on learning new things and probably pretty tough things, like learning a second language or a third language at, you know, in later ages. He's shown that pretty clearly. The research shows that this is happening and can happen, and it's more or less overturned the whole sense for the past 400 years that the brain is hardwired from the beginning and it can change. My question is, given that it's shown to be true that we can do this, is this also true for Alzheimer's patients? Because I've heard recent research that shows nothing helps. And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Deb, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Maybe both of our guests. Let's turn to Tipa first. Tipa, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah. One of the challenges is absolutely our brains are very plastic. They're very, it's very possible to continue to learn and to grow those new networks. However, when Alzheimer's hits, what it literally does is it causes your brain cells to actually lose their arms and their legs, if you will, those connections. And so it's actually shriveling those up and making it more and more difficult for a brain cell to connect, let alone form new connections. So typically what we see with Alzheimer's is the first thing that goes is the ability to hold on to that new stuff. Although emotional connections can be made, it's that factual detailed stuff that folks with Alzheimer's have such a challenge with. And yet, that being said, sometimes people can, and we aren't sure of the pathway of how they go from not knowing something, not knowing it, and sometimes getting it into the long-term storage units. And it's very complex, but realistically, we've got to look at not anticipating or expecting once someone does have the disease of Alzheimer's that we expect them to be able to do new things. All we're going to get is frustrated, and they're going to get overwhelmed. We want to look at how we can be supportive with what's happening for their brain. The challenge for us is recognizing when I'm caring for that person with dementia, I actually get the opportunity to grow new connections if I'm willing to, but it's easier said than done when it's a family member.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking today about caring for loved ones with dementia. Our guests today, Susanna Waters-Castillo, who is with the programs on aging and long-term care in the Division of Continuing Study at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Tipa Snow, with us by phone, certified occupational therapist, dementia expert, trains and consults for healthcare professionals and families privately. Great to have them along. And again, join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dealing with dementia today with our two guests, Susanna Waters-Castillo and Tipa Snow, and Michael in Decorah, Iowa, is up next with a question. So let's go there. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I'm Michael from Decorah. My grandmother passed away from Alzheimer's not long ago, and I'd just like to say I agree with what Tipa was saying before about the toggle switch at first. You didn't know if she was just forgetting things because of old age or if it was Alzheimer's. And then as it progressed, she became very emotional. She'd be crying over things that to those without it are trivial matters. My question is, what she seemed to remember even up to the last month before she passed, she was a World War II Red Cross veteran, and she always remembered certain things about that. She never forgot them and was able to recite them correctly. So I was wondering if that's unique or if that seems to be common, that very long-term memories are preserved.
Susanna Castillo, let's go to you.
Well, that's an important point to raise. Some people refer to what your grandmother experienced as crystallized memory. And in addition to the pathological nature of the disease, there are certain types of life experiences that seem to remain with us along almost parallel with the disease. I worked with an older man, and he, unbeknownst to the rest of the staff, including myself, had been an opera singer, and he could sing in Italian. This was a hobby of his. And we had taken him out on the town one night. He had kind of mid-stage Alzheimer's dementia. And there was a lively group, and he started singing in Italian beautifully. And we were just stunned. So we know that certain kinds of environments can bring those crystallized memories back, can stimulate that. And that reminds us of the importance of honoring the person. We're often overwhelmed by all of the disease facts, which are very important. But as you will learn in when working with TIPA, that so much of what we do has to do with basic skills that are related to who that individual is, enhancing the abilities that they have left, and then also recognizing some of these very important aspects of who this human being has been. People don't forget to play the piano. They can speak in their original language, etc., etc.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ferdinand in Oshkosh, I'll give you a chance now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, one of the things I was wondering about is if they have come up with any research or anything where, well, when my grandma was in her 70s, she fell and broke her arm, and they put her on painkillers and stuff like that. And even though I had been seeing her on a daily basis, once she was on those painkillers, she didn't know who I was. Yeah. And then several years later, she had to get another operation done to remove part of her leg. And once they put her on, you know, painkillers for that, the same thing started happening where, you know, my aunts and uncles were trying to help her make this decision, and one day it was she understood, knew what was going on, and then the next day she was like, oh, well, why are you doing this to me? Why are you doing this to me?
Yeah. I think we got the gist of your. Thank you very much for calling on that question, and tell you what, Ferdinand, Susanna was shaking her head yes, as if she really understood what's going on. And I Tipa probably too, but Susanna, do you want to?
Yes, that's one of the areas we really work to educate people on, is it could be a form of pseudo-dementia, which is reversible. When someone has what we call medication management issues, that's why you put pain medications, your metabolism as you age changes, the absorption rate through your intestinal tract changes as you age, and so the impact of a very strong medication like a painkiller can change your cognitive and emotional response to the world around you. And so speaking with a pharmacist about the impact of that, very carefully monitoring, and then talking to the doctor to see if those should be withdrawn, because they can prompt a delusional experience, which can be devastating for the individual. And I think TIPA will be talking about that sort of thing as well, the reversible side of what may appear to be a dementia. And this is why I mentioned it's so important for people to get proper screening and look at the symptoms, but not jump to conclusions. And let me just say this, that TIPA is going to be in Madison speaking this July for 2 days, July 28th and July 29th at the Pyle Center. And one of the reasons I wanted her to come is she really can offer people the skills that they need, some very concrete tools. She'll talk about very early stage, mid stage, and late stage, right to the terminal aspect of dementia, and how to skillfully help that person be treated with respect and understanding and meet the challenges and really give that caregiver some real solid skills to work with and guidelines.
And that's the 28th and 29th of July in Madison at the Pyle Center.
Right.
Which is on the UW-Madison campus.
And right.
And this is open to...
Yes, it's really a seminar for professionals that are working with older adults. We do have information on our division's website that also will assist people with some of the basic information about Alzheimer's disease. I myself and some other professionals teach that. But this seminar is geared for professionals who are working with older adults who have dementia, and it will be at UW-Madison's Pyle Center. You can go on to our division's website at www.continuingstudies.wisc.edu.
And also we have that listed on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, so we've got a link there to that. So if just go to The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you can click on the link and you can get right to it. Actually, we also have on the Judith put up the federal site of the National Institutes of Health page on dementia. So we have that up as well. So she put both those up, and I think those are worthwhile, definitely worthwhile places to go. Tipa, did you have a comment? I'm sorry.
Well, I would like to make one comment, which is the gentleman said something about, you know, the forgetfulness that's normal for aging. Mm. And there is some level of, it's harder for us to remember things as we get a little older, but there is no such thing as dementia normal for age. And the kind of forgetfulness that we're talking about with normal aging, we can use compensatory strategies and cues to work our way through it. And if I had accidentally, for instance, laid my car keys down in the freezer when I was putting away ice cream, and then later on I'm going, now where are my car keys? My Lord, I can't find them. Well, we have a variety of cueing strategies we tend to use, which is visual, verbal, or movement cues that help us remember things. So I'll first look around and not be able to find them, and then I'll start talking to myself. Now, where did I put those? What was I doing? And then I'll actually backtrack. Now, the difference between dementia and not dementia is when I find those car keys in the freezer, there's that, oh, crap, of course, yes, that's, I was putting the ice, yeah, that's right. There's an aha moment that occurs for me with normal aging that, unfortunately, when it's a dementia, some form of dementia, if it's a memory problem, I look at those car keys and I still have no idea how they got there. And so I may get accusatory. Why are you doing this to me? You put my... Or I may get very sad. Oh, my God, how did this happen? I don't understand. And I become anxious or depressed and sad. And so that's why it's so critical to recognize normal versus not normal. It's a little... There is some difference. And we tend to think, well, you know, she's 82, and we need to stop that nonsense. Mm-hmm. That is so not helpful in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah. Well, Sandra emailed us from Madison, says, my mother has been diagnosed with vascular dementia for several years. However, she has some very distinct symptoms associated with Lewy body dementia, mm-hmm. which include hallucinations of small children. How important is it to have the correct diagnosis as long as you know it's dementia and not depression, for example?
Critical.
Yes, absolutely.
Just people going, critical, critical, especially with Lewy body, because 50% of those folks can have a hypersensitivity to medications that are traditionally used to treat hallucinations, and it makes them unable to move or more unsafe in their movement. And movement problems is one of the other most common symptoms with Lewy body, mm-hmm. falls, And that's why you want somebody who knows what they're doing, really looking at the whole constellation, because we've got 70 to 80 different conditions that fall under the umbrella of dementia, mm-hmm. and they're different.
Yeah. Genevieve in Madison says, I think one of the difficult things in caring for someone with dementia is imagining yourself going through mm-hmm. that process. So you're experiencing what your loved one has gone on. and it grieving that, and also you're fearing that the future could bring that for yourself. And that's, I've got to say, I mean, that would be on my mind. My mother was an Alzheimer's, so there's some chance that, better chance than average, that I might have that at some day.
Yes, I mean, that is certainly a concern. It's the, you know, the empathy that you have and the identification. However, I think part of the if there can be consolation, is knowing that we have professionals that do have the skills to assuage some of that incredible emotional distress that people experience when they cannot find what they are looking for, don't have the insight, don't recognize a person that wants to give them a bath or have them go to the bathroom, and that we're getting better at identifying how we can, on psychosocial terms, more effectively work with people, and to do that as a team, so that that family member is not out there solo. And again, that's where the role of care managers can come in the community to bring, it takes a whole village to raise a child. Well, it takes a whole village to take care of an older person that has dementia.
Sarah in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
My question is, I have a 90-year-old mother who's in a nursing home. There was a little accident at the nursing home, and they dropped her, and she broke her femur.
Oh.
She's been in a wheelchair. She cannot put any weight. She hasn't been putting weight on her legs in years. So she's completely immobile even before this accident occurred. Now the accident has occurred, and one side is saying you got to have surgery to mend the break, and another side is saying, oh my gosh, she has dementia, she doesn't really know where she is, but if we take her to a convalescent home for rehab, she'll be even more mixed up. And I'm just curious, in terms of the dementia side of this argument, to do the surgery or not, by having her go through surgery and medication and anesthesia, and then moving her to yet another nursing facility for the post-operation care, are we going to just completely ruin her quality of life, which is limited even now?
Yeah. That's a tough one. Tipa, a comment from you?
Well, I mean, you certainly have a handle on how complex this is. One of the questions is what is the quality of her life right now? And is she pain-free, or does she have a lot of pain when they try to mobilize her, even though she's not weight-bearing? That unstable fractured femur, you know, if it can't be stabilized with a non-surgical procedure, it means every time someone tries to do anything in her care, including continence care, which is, I can't imagine at this point in time that is not also an issue, incontinence and having to help her get clean. That becomes very uncomfortable and very painful and very distressing. And it basically, where we talked about pain meds can cause your brain not to work, so can pain. Mm-hmm. So we know that hip fracture repairs are quite risky. But we also know not getting them is risky. So this is one of those cases where, as Suzanne mentioned, a case manager, you really want someone who's going to work with you and talk with you through this. There's no right and wrong answer. It's complex, and you really want somebody who's going to help you think through the pros and cons and come to where it's best for you and best for your mom, because it's not going to be simple.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone else was wondering, would a family disaster, so to speak, the spouse dies, or elderly people, or there's a divorce or something like that, can that trigger or hasten the onset of something like dementia?
Well, it'll certainly get you to notice the symptoms that may have been bubbling under the surface. Because if you lose the primary, and it's very, very common for spouses or primary folks around to be covering and not even realize they're doing it, because it's been a gradual onset, so they just sort of get used to it. But when that person or that situation dramatically changes, then the person who'd been hanging on by a fingernail suddenly, I mean, you're going, oh, my heavens, this came out of nowhere. And, in fact, probably not. If we had been a little more careful, we would have noticed sort of the early, early signs. But they were under the water, and Dad didn't want everybody to know that Mom was struggling. And we just gradually had the events more at our houses, and she was more of a visitor. And we did have those few little things where she put the turkey in the bathtub instead of cooking it, and we found it later, and everybody laughed. But that went by the wayside, and now Dad died, or Dad's in the hospital, and suddenly me, the daughter, is going, oh, my God, Mom's out of it. I mean, she doesn't even know what's going on. She tried to go to Chicago, and she lives in Minnesota. I mean, what is she doing? Well, they used to live in Chicago, and so now she's doing a little time travel. So that would be a comment I would make.
Yeah. And the other thing is simply to, I recommend, and they do this at the early diagnostic and screening centers around the state, is to evaluate for depression, because depression so frequently accompanies dementia. And the fact that an individual may have had an underlying anxiety disorder, depression, that didn't show up until a crisis in their life. And the depression can be treated that accompanies the dementia, because we don't want the individual to be suffering from both of those disorders, because it adds to the complexity of treatment and the emotional distress of the person with the disorder.
What about people, well, say like myself or other family members who say, oh my gosh, I wonder if I shouldn't be tested, or are there things going on, research going on? I think there's something at the UW,
yes,
for example.
There is. You know, that I hear people ask that question a lot. I encourage them to read as much as they can from evidence-based resources. Obviously, they need to talk with their primary care provider first off. They can call and speak to someone at the Alzheimer's Alliance that covers about 8 counties here in South Central Wisconsin, or the Alzheimer's Association throughout the state. And talk with someone that can listen to their concerns and that might be able to make a recommendation. I think the most difficult situation would be to worry about it and not talk to an expert about it. Rather, they're just simply holding that, because there are different levels of testing that an individual can have. Here at the university, there is a very, very large, sophisticated study going on that goes beyond the type of screening tools that are based on communication, basically, and skill expression at the early diagnostic sites that are actual physiological exams, so to speak. So there are various levels, various steps, but don't just suffer alone. Get some expert advice.
Let's turn to Bob in Middleton next. Bob, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I'm concerned. Even with the best treatment, dementia is very hard to treat in the elderly, in my experience. What does a family member do when you're at the bedside of someone who has severe dementia and they're extremely anxious or upset or angry, and you don't seem able to comfort them in any way? What can you do to help a relative right at the bedside, not at the diagnosis level or
sure.
the treatment? What's reassuring? Do you contradict? What do you do?
No. Suzanne, I'll turn to you first.
Well, I'll share this with Tipa, because Tipa will also be talking about this. But a contradicting an individual that is suffering and has cognitive impairment, and their central nervous system is probably hypersensitive at the point when they're very angry, and what is left of the cognitive process can't sort through. So first of all, you would certainly want to find out if there is a medication problem, if there is a urinary tract. All of those have to be explored.
I have done all those things.
Okay. Then,
right at that moment.
Okay, right at that moment.
Right.
Are they safe?
Yes.
Okay, they're safe. And are you familiar with anything that can comfort them or has comforted them in the past? The touch of a soft garment, comforting stuffed toy, anything of that nature. What you want to avoid are sounds. You want to look around the room to see if there's any abrasive light, abrasive sounds that may not even seem that way to you, but could be for that individual. You look environmentally. And in a way, it's almost like palliative care. Tipa, can you talk to that, the whole issue of providing comfort?
Yeah, the first thing we want to do is, number one, connect. And that means visually connecting, verbally connecting, and through touch. Now, if somebody's really upset, we need to be real sensitive to public space, personal space, intimate space. And all too often, we try to invade the intimate space mm-hmm. in our effort to try to connect. And what we're doing is pushing even harder in a system that is stressed. So we're going to need to back up a little bit and say, whatever they say to you. So if I said, I want to get out of here, then you want to say, I hear you saying you want to get out of here. You don't like it here. You need to put some emotion in your voice so if you're not separating yourself from them. What you want to do is go where they are and then bring them back safely. And that means through words, through touch, and through your visual. So you need to move. I have a whole strategy of moving to the side and getting down so they don't feel threatened at all. Offering but not pushing. And then you use, it's called go with the flow. You don't use reality orientation, but you also don't do big whopper lies because you're going to get caught or you're going to distress them because they know you're lying. And instead, you deal with empathy and you validate what you can. You don't like it here. You hate this. You're so upset. This is so stressful. You want to go home. Yeah. Yeah. This is really hard, Mom. You really want to go home. You don't want this. And often just by being willing to step forward and go where they are, you can calm them down. They're so afraid, they're so alone, they're so upset, and it feels like nobody gets it. And once we get it, their stress level drops immediately because it's like, okay, you're with me. It's okay now.
Oh.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that's probably information that a lot of people listen to very carefully and I think is... great information to have. And I know there's, as we said, there are places where people can go for information.
I have the Alzheimer's Alliance toll-free number I can list here.
What, would you give that?
It's 888-308-6251.
So that's 888-308-6251. Judith, maybe we can post that on our Facebook pages. She'll post that up on the Facebook page as a help.
Yes.
I know there are people who aren't on Facebook, so we'll give that again, 888-308-6251.
I also have a website that it has some little YouTube things on it on how to approach and how to engage folks. So if folks have access to the internet and they want to see what are some strategies that work well because they acknowledge and recognize what's gone, but they use what's left, that might be something that might be helpful to folks.
Absolutely. And could you give us that?
And it's real simple. It's tipasnow.com.
TipaSnow.com, and Judith's got her giving me the thumbs up. She's going to put that up on our Facebook page as well. And don't forget, I want to mention again the workshop on July 28th and 29th. And to find out more, we go to we also have that up on our Facebook page right now. So that's a link we have at the Larry Mueller Show. If you want to get some more information on getting involved in it, you certainly can. And
Let me add that there is another website, the Wisconsin Geriatric Psychiatry Initiative, mm-hmm. which is www.wgpi.org.
WGPI.org.
Right.
Susanna, Tipa, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it, and I hope we have a chance to visit again about this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tipa.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Susanna Waters Castillo is with the Programs on Aging and Long-Term Care in the Division of Continuing Study at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Tipa Snow with us by phone today as a certified occupational therapist and dementia expert who trains and consults for healthcare professionals and families privately as well. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.